Welcome to the Afford Anything podcast. Next week, we're airing episode 500. In honor of that, we are airing a special five-day series in which we look back on the earliest days of this podcast. In case you missed it, we air five of our greatest hits. So five episodes in 5 days in honor of episode 500. Today is day four of five. And today we're sharing an interview with AJ Jacobs, the editor-at-large of Esquire magazine, the author of multiple New York Times best-selling books, and whose three TED Talks have collectively garnered more than 3 million views. In this interview, AJ Jacobs describes how he manages his motivation and habits. He shares some of the behavioral tactics that have come from the research that he's done for stories at Esquire magazine, including acting in a certain way until your mind catches up, and finding the initial momentum to act your way into a new mode of thinking. This interview originally aired in 2017. Back then, our audience was much smaller, so you might not have caught it the first time it aired, which is why this week, Greatest Hits Week, we are pulling it out of our early days archives to share it with you. Please note, while there is no profanity in this interview, we do discuss certain adult topics. So if you're listening with kids in the car, please be aware that there are certain elements of this interview that are not totally kid safe. So please enjoy this interview with AJ Jacobs, which originally aired in 2017. Hey, Cousin AJ.
Hello, cousin. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's good to be talking to a long-lost cousin like yourself, a cousin I've never met.
I know. I feel we are very close cousins, probably like 14th or 15th.
Absolutely. For all the listeners who are wondering what we're talking about, we'll get to that at the end. But first, AJ, I actually wanted you to know, in order to facilitate a better interview today, I tried as close as I could to dress head to toe in white.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you, Paula. I wish I were. I'm wearing blue, but I wish I were wearing white.
I know everyone who's listening is wondering what on earth we're talking about. That concept came from one of your many books in which you completely dove into a new culture to figure out how it would change your headspace. And so that concept, the concept of wearing white, was from your book called A Year of Living Biblically. Will you talk about that for a little bit?
Sure. That's what I like to do is sort of do these experiments, radical self-improvement. I need a lot of improvement. I grew up with no religion at all. As I say in my book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. So not very, but I wanted to see if there was anything in the Bible that would make my life better. So I thought I would follow it as literally as possible. So I followed the famous ones, the Ten Commandments, but I also grew this huge beard because the Bible says to grow a beard. I didn't wear clothes made of mixed fibers, no poly cotton blends. That's in the Bible, weirdly enough. And speaking of clothes, there is a line in the Bible that says you should only wear white garments. So there's a lot of stuff people don't know or remember in the Bible. And I started to do that. And the weird thing about it was, it actually was a lovely practice because I felt much lighter. I felt like I was, you know, off to play Wimbledon or go to P. Diddy's party. And it was a real lesson. And this is throughout all of my books, I found that the outer affects the inner, that the way you act or dress or behave eventually sinks in with your brain. And that I found to be one of the most useful things in my life. Not necessarily wearing white, which I do endorse, but just acting in a certain way until your mind catches up.
One of the examples that you gave that always stood out to me was when you bought your wife a present every day for 30 days. And by the end of the month, you discovered that you felt more loving towards her because you were acting that way.
Oh, yeah. I totally tricked my brain. I was like, oh, I'm buying her all of these little books and magnets. I must really love her. And then you start to. Your brain is not very smart, or mine isn't. I can't speak for yours. But yeah, it could be anything. It could be another one I find very useful is I don't think I was born very confident. But I do believe you need confidence and optimism to get things done. So I'll try to act in a confident way. I was writing a book about health And I was just, I woke up every day full of despair. You know, this book is too big. I can't get a handle on it. It was about trying to be the healthiest person alive, by the way. But then I said, okay, I'm going to act as if I'm confident. So I would call my publisher and say, okay, when the book comes out, let's have a big party and serve kale martinis. And, you know, I would just pretend that it was going to be a hit. And after a couple of hours of this, my brain caught up with my actions. And I was like, you know what? I feel good about this book. And I was finally able to write it because of that feeling.
How did you deal with, because I remember in interviews, you talked about how there was some part of you that wondered, like, wait a minute, what if I go on book tour for a book in which I'm supposed to be the healthiest man in the world? And what if on that book tour, I'm like a little bit overweight and also sick?
That was a very stressful book. Exactly. I sort of made my bed, and luckily I did not get sick on the tour. But yeah, I think that's just a risk. Every project, you know, whether you're a writer or an accountant or whatever, there's going to be an element of risk. And I'm pretty conservative. I don't like to take too huge a risk. But I thought that was a risk worth taking.
You dealt with that by being confident, like pretending that you were confident until you actually felt that way?
Exactly. And also, you know, acting in a healthy way, even if I didn't feel healthy. So I did do the, you know, eating and relatively healthy exercise. And also the stress. Stress, I think, is, people talk about exercise and food, but really stress is just as important. So trying not to be stressed. And I figured out all of these little hacks. Some work better than others. But just to give you one example, human touch is actually very good at stress relief. I think we were evolutionarily meant to sort of groom each other. So even holding my wife's hand is good for stress. There are studies that say holding strangers' hands does lower your stress level. I did not find that. Like trying to hold a stranger's hand just caused a very awkward and unpleasant situation. So I don't recommend that, but there is evidence that it does if you can get over the awkwardness and sexual harassment claims.
That would be a bad day on the New York City subway.
Exactly. Very dangerous.
I've also heard you in interviews quote the founder of Habitat for Humanity saying, it's easier to act your way into a new way of feeling. And I've heard you in interviews talk about how you have found time and time again with all of your experiments, whether it's living biblically or outsourcing every aspect of your life or all of these different assignments, you have always acted your way into a new type of thinking and feeling.
Right.
How do you kickstart that? Like, how do you get that initial momentum, even when you don't feel like it?
That's a great question. And I do believe that it is extremely effective. I love that quote you had. It's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting. I mean, there are shorter versions, fake it till you make it, or fake it till you become it, which is Amy Cuddy's version. I like that. Deed before creed is another one they say. But anyway, I think, yeah, the kickstarting is an interesting conundrum. I would say one thing I do is almost just convince myself I'm an actor. It's almost like, you know, there's method acting. So what about method writing or method living? So you say, you know, this is just an experiment. Keep in mind, I can always go back, but let's see what happens if this makes my life better. And that's also one of my big themes, is that you don't have to be writing about this stuff to do it. But I do think that everyone doing little experiments with their lives can improve their happiness. And it could be trying a new toothpaste. You know, I had been using the same toothpaste for 30 years because some kid at camp liked Crest. And I was like, okay, he's cool. I guess I'll do Crest. But, you know, change it up. See if you like something better. Take a different way to work. I do think the experimental mindset is really important to happiness.
I want to dive into that a little bit. Since you've started running all these experiments in your life, have you found that your overall life satisfaction has increased? Or do you have more moments of peak happiness during the day?
I do think I am certainly much happier than I was 20 years ago. I mean, it's a little bit of a correlation causation problem because I am. The books actually have done relatively well, so I've been able to make a living at doing something I love. So it's possible that I would have been, without that, I would still be miserable. But I do think I am happier. I'm certainly not perfectly happy, but happier. And part of it is just, yeah, this mindset of trying things out. And also another big theme that I think affects my happiness is the idea of gratitude. For instance, in the Bible, it says you got to be thankful for everything. I took that quite literally, and I started being grateful for the tiniest things, like pressing the elevator button. I was grateful the elevator came, or I get in the elevator, I'm grateful it doesn't plummet and break my pelvis. So there are hundreds of things every day that we just take for granted. I try to start to be aware of them instead of focusing on the three or four that went wrong, which is sort of my default mode. And that has genuinely improved my life, just being so aware. Anytime you're on a line that's short at the pharmacy, just make a note of that. So the next time you're on a long line, be like, you know what? It balances out. So I would say these hacks have made my life better overall.
Your example about the line also reminds me of the time that you tried to be the most rational person in the world, because that's also a cognitive bias that we have, is negativity bias.
Right. I loved that experiment. I'm glad you read that. Thank you, Paula. But yeah, that one, as you say, it was all about the hundreds of cognitive biases we have in our brain, and they are just terrible. Like, our brain, it's got some good parts, but it was built for caveman times. So I don't trust my brain. I feel I have to be a babysitter to my brain and make sure it doesn't go into these negative places.
So as you're trying these different experiments, how do you stick with it? Like, you know, you might decide that you're going to chew every bite very slowly. And sure, you'll do that for the first or second meal. But how do you stick with it meal after meal? Right. And how frequently do you fall off the wagon?
Oh, well, certainly I fall off the wagon quite a bit. I mean, one very effective method, I think, is public humiliation. So telling everyone you know that you're doing this, you know, I'm going to be a vegetarian for a week. And then if you go out to dinner with friends, they can mock you if you're not. So a little bit of accountability is good. I mean, I found that too when I do try to still get 10,000 steps a day. And I was on this board where friends could see how many steps I did and mock me relentlessly if I did not achieve them. I found that very, very motivating. So yeah, getting it out into the public is a good thing.
When you do fall off the wagon, have you noticed any common triggers that precede that?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, one thing is I find I am more motivated by the idea that whatever I'm doing could be helpful to others. Like with health, for instance, if I'm just thinking about I want to be healthy because I want to have abs, which I've never had and never will, that's not very motivating to me. But if I'm thinking, you know what, I want to be healthy because I want to live to be around for my kids, you know, so I can see them, you know, join a band or get married or whatever they end up doing, I want to be around for them. So trying to see that your motivation is not just for you, but for other people, that helps me stay on course. And it's interesting, I've noticed this. I listened to an interview with Kanye West a long time ago, and it was very surprising because I don't think he's a very... I'm not a big fan because I think he's an egomaniac, but I did like that he said his music makes people happy and that's what motivates him. So it was a little break in what I had always thought of his extreme egomania. So yeah, trying to do it for other people.
Can you describe a day in the life? Like, what's your morning routine? Give me some insight into the world of AJ Jacobs.
Oh, I'm happy to. I hope that, I'm not sure it's interesting, but I'm happy to share. Excuse me. I'm talking about health and I'm coughing. That's not good. Well, I have a tiny little office because I do find like a rented shared workspace. I do find if I try to work from home, there is no way that anything gets done because it's just too distracting. Although I will say the sad part is I used to write more on my treadmill desk when I worked at home. Now I can't fit a treadmill into this office. But I walk to work listening to podcasts like yours, which I love. I listen on double speed. So this is the first time I've ever heard you talking at a normal rate. And I'm worried that there's something wrong with you. Are you feeling okay? I am a big fan of, and this does not go over well with people who make movies or TV shows, but I like to, there's a hack where you can download movies from YouTube and watch them in double speed. I recently watched Manchester by the Sea in double speed, and I thought it was slow in double speed. So I don't know how people could sit through that in the theater, but more power to them. All right. So anyway, I get to my office, and in terms of my job, there are parts that I like and parts that I don't. The part I don't like is writing. I am a writer who does not like to write.
I don't think any writers like writing. I think writers enjoy having had written.
Exactly. I am with you, Paula. Yeah. I know a friend of mine who's a writer says he thinks of it as sort of a like a stomach flu. Like you have to upchuck it and then you feel better. So, I do love the researching part. That is what I find. And also, weirdly, the marketing, which I know is not usual for writers. I do like the marketing. But yeah, researching, for instance, I'm working on a book that won't come out for another year, but it's called Thank You All. And it's about, I take one of my joys, my morning cup of coffee, and I try to thank every single person in the world who helped make it a reality. So not just the barista, but I went to Colombia and thanked the farmers and the truckers, the people who designed the logo. And you can go as far as, you know, it could be the people who make the tires for the trucks and who got the rubber to make the tires. The idea was just to show that there are thousands of people involved in every little thing that we do.
Wow.
And we kind of take that for granted, or certainly I did.
That's amazing. When I hear that, I think of kind of a combination between this concept of how we're all family, as well as the concept of being grateful when you press an elevator button. Like I hear a merging of those two ideas.
That's true. I have my themes that I seem to gravitate towards. But hopefully it's different enough from anything else.
Well, I think it's a beautiful synthesis of those ideas. It's taking it to the next level. So I'm very excited to read that book.
Oh, thanks, Paula. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm in the midst of writing it. I'm trying to be grateful to the people who, you know, make my power book. But I still hate writing.
Right. So I've gotten off track. All right. So you get to the office and you hate writing.
I hate writing, but hopefully I'm doing something more interesting like researching. Like I went for this book, I went to the reservoir in the New York City reservoir, which is like 90 miles north, to thank everyone. And you just forget how amazing it is that we can turn a little knob and have fresh, safe water. That's like shocking. That is not true for 99% of the history and certainly not for a lot of the world. But if I'm not doing that, I'm writing. And then, yeah, I just get home and I am on call as homework helper / cleaner / other boring fatherly duties. And then I put the kids to bed and then I start working again because I do find it's a constant struggle because I do. And as any entrepreneur, I feel that you could always be doing more. You could always be doing more. And I feel that guilt. And I don't know. I think it's probably not healthy. I should learn to turn it off a little more. But I do find those hours between 6 and 10, I totally turn it off. And I'm like, you know what? This is devoted to family. I'm not going to work. And there's something very liberating about that, because I used to try to be like, okay, I'm going to help them and then I'll take a break and send some emails. And it was very stressful and not efficient because I was always looking for the. So now I'm just, I have this, it's almost like a Sabbath. I'm like from 6 to 10, no work, just devoted to the family.
Nice. What time do you normally go to bed and wake up?
Well, this is not healthy either because sleep is so hugely important to our health. But I go to bed at about, I would say 1, and I wake up at about 7:30.
10 seconds on the clock. How many things can you name that are always growing? Like your hair, your net worth, I hope. Your income, your investment portfolio. Again, I hope. Hey, how about the revenue in the business that you run on Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, whether you just started or whether you've been in business for 10 years, whether you're selling accounting textbooks or windshield wiper repair kits, and whether you're selling in person or online. If you're online, know that Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can leverage AI with Shopify Magic, an AI-powered all-star. Now, what I like about Shopify is that it's there for you whether you are just beginning or whether you are doing your first million in revenue, your first dollar to your first million plus. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. They have award-winning help. And businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. So, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Paula, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Paula now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Paula. This episode is sponsored by State Farm. Are you a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Hiring? With Indeed, your search is over. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is a matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, and you can use it for scheduling, screening, and messaging. In addition to helping you hire faster, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Now, inside of Afford Anything, I've had to hire many people over the years, and when I hire, I do so because we already are overloaded with work, and we already are overwhelmed. And so using a platform like Indeed, which makes hiring both faster and easier, as well as better, it helps you find higher quality matches, solves a problem that you most likely have if you are hiring. You probably don't need even more stress and work added to your plate. Now, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses around the world that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Paula. Just go to Indeed.com/Paula right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Paula. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Well, I will tell you this anecdote. I write for Esquire magazine sometimes, and I had to do this story on Scarlett Johansson. I didn't have to. I mean, it wasn't a chore. She's a lovely person. But I was, asking her questions, and she's like, God, you're asking a lot of questions about my personal life. And I was like, well, listen, if you want to ask me about my personal life, I'm open. I'm an open book. And so she took my notebook and my pen and just started grilling me about the most, have you ever had an STD? When did you lose your virginity? And really going at it. I was like, all right.
So did you answer all of her questions?
I did. Why not? I believe in transparency most of the time. So, the good thing is I had control over what went in the article. So that that helped. If she had her own magazine, then it might have been a little more tricky.
There was that one time you had to pose nude, didn't you, for one of the models? Didn't one of the models request that?
Yes, that was a humiliating experience, but enlightening at the same time. Yeah, one of the this was at Esquire magazine. My boss wanted me to write an article about Mary Louise Parker, the actress, or edit an article. He said, well, can you ask her to pose nude, tastefully nude, but we do enjoy nude photography. I was like, oh boy. So I asked her and she said, all right, I'll do it, but only if the editor of the piece also poses nude so he can see what it feels like and go through the experience himself. And that was me. I was the editor of the piece. So my boss was like, all right, she said, she challenged you. So I did. I took off my clothes and I was tastefully photographed by a professional like Hollywood photographer. I did cover up my privates and I did suck in my gut. He kept telling me, suck in your gut. And it did appear, you know, there's this beautiful series of pages of her naked, and then there's a page of me naked. And I think it was a shock to some of our readers. We did get a couple of cancellations, I believe. But I did love her. I loved her moxie. I loved her, the idea. You know what? This is something, if you're going to ask other people to do, you should have to do it yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. That's totally fair.
Totally fair, right?
Yeah. Tell me about how we're all cousins.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is my new project. My book, It's All Relative, is coming out. And this one started a couple of years ago, and I got this weird email that said, you don't know me, but I've read your books, and you're my eighth cousin. And I figured, as you probably would, as you probably advise your listeners, that there's a lot of scammers. So this guy was going to ask me to send $10,000 to Nigeria. But it turns out he was legit, and he is my eighth cousin, and he and a group of other people are building these huge family trees. But they're not just trees. They're like forests, interlocking jungles of family. And it turns out, because of DNA and the internet, it's this revolution where we are going to have eventually a family tree of every single person on Earth. So you can think, and it's already quite large. It's already about 200 million people, all related. So it's sort of like a Kevin Bacon. You can figure out how you're linked to almost everyone. For instance, Barack Obama is my fifth great aunt's husband's father's wife's seventh great nephew. So he's quite close to me. And Paul, I hopefully after this interview, I'll go on the tree and figure out how you and I are linked. But it's sort of the ultimate social network, and I was fascinated by it. So I wrote a whole book about family and all the amazing things happening in family, the huge changes, the DNA. And also, since you are a sort of a business finance podcast, there was an interesting business angle to it, because these family trees turned out to be like better than LinkedIn, because I wanted to get people's attention. So I would try to get TV producers or reporters. And what I would do is I would figure out how they were related to me and then say, this may sound weird, but you're my distant cousin. Would you be interested in talking to me about? And, you know, 20% of them were like, you know, don't ever bother me again. But 80% weirdly were like, you know, that's interesting. People like a connection, whether even if it's a distant one. And I remember I wanted to interview George H.W. Bush, the elder Bush, about family, because he's got such a large and famous one. And so I emailed his chief of staff, and she's like, well, the president doesn't do interviews anymore. And I said, well, yeah, but I am his cousin, and here's how, so maybe for a family. And she laughed, and she's like, okay. And I went down there and had a lovely time with the former president.
That's fantastic. You know, and when I reached out to you, my opening line was, hey, I'm probably your cousin, but I bet you get that a lot.
Well, no, it totally worked. I was like, you know what? I really better to respond. I do not want to anger my family. There's an MIT study that says even people who are from very niche and sort of insular backgrounds, even they are far more integrated than they think, because some of your cousins have no doubt married outside of that system, even if you don't know it. So the estimate is the farthest cousin you have on Earth is about a 70th cousin, which is not all that far. I mean, most of us are more like, you know, 10th or 11th or 12th cousins, but say a yam farmer in New Guinea, he might be your 70th cousin.
That's a good tip for reaching out to people on LinkedIn. Thank you. Digressing away from the topic of how we're all distant cousins, I'd like to switch gears and ask what advice you have about honing your mind for better performance, especially with regard to the creative process. And so specifically, I wanted to ask, how did you learn how to be funny?
I remember a comedy writer I know. He was one of the original Saturday Night Live writers. And he talks about how he likes to think he has a second head on his shoulder. So he's sort of living his life, but that second head is evaluating all the time and saying, oh my God, that's so weird. Or isn't that curious and funny? I wonder if you can do a bit about that. So always having that awareness. And also I think that it's certainly not a science, of course, but there are methods you can use to help you in certain types of humor. Like, for instance, my first book, it's called The Two Kings, and it's about the eerie similarities between Elvis and Jesus. And it really shouldn't have been a book. It started as an article, and that's pretty much where it should have stayed. But listen, I wasn't going to turn it down when they offered me a book. But the idea was to find similarities between these two characters, because the idea was Elvis actually once said he thought he might be the second coming of Jesus. So sort of a satirical look at, well, maybe he is. And for that one, I just took a bunch of notebooks and I split them down the middle. And I wrote everything I could think of or research about Elvis on one side, and then everything I could about Jesus on the other. And then you sort of start to make connections. So, you know, Elvis dated Sybil Shepherd and Jesus was the Lord's shepherd. So, hey, maybe there's something there. So there are ways to do it. And I am actually a fan of carving out 15 minutes a day just for brainstorming. It doesn't have to be humor, but just to come up with random ideas, 98% of which are going to be useless or terrible, but 2% might be useful. And more than that, it's like a muscle. I feel it keeps my brain a little more creative, so that when I do need to come up with a solution, maybe I'll be in a better way. You know, if I do have a flat tire, maybe I'll have an easier time coming up with a way to fix it.
When do you do your 15-minute brainstorm? Is that first thing when you get to the office, or is that more at night?
It's usually I take a break right around now, actually. So yeah, if I'm sort of losing steam on the morning, take a little break, brainstorm, and then maybe get my second wind.
All right. Well, are there any other questions I've missed, or is there anything else you'd like to mention?
Well, there's one last story. Since we talked a lot in the beginning about the fake it till you make it and having this confidence, I do remember when I interviewed George Clooney for Esquire, he had a similar philosophy where he said he played high school or college baseball, and he would get up there to the plate and say, he wouldn't ask, am I going to hit a home run? He'd say, which field am I going to hit a home run to, left field, center, or right? And that helped him be a better hitter. Of course, most of the time he still struck out or grounded out, but this sort of delusional optimism helped him in his overall hitting. So I do like that idea of delusional optimism with caveats, because you don't want to be too delusionally optimistic or else you end up doing crazy things.
Has there ever been a time when you've been too delusionally optimistic and it's come back to bite you in the butt?
Well, I would say, I mean, there are certainly books or articles that I've started and been very optimistic that they'll work out, but they never do. And that's fine. I mean, I think you have to become you don't have to love failure, but you certainly have to accept it and realize that it's all part of the process.
Right, right. I'm probably delusionally optimistic about my schedule, the number of things I think I can do in a day.
Oh, yeah. Well, that is an official cognitive bias. I forget what it's called, the planning bias, maybe. Yeah, we all think we can do a lot more than we can.
There's a great quote, I think it's by Jim Rohn, that we overestimate what we can do in a day, but underestimate what we can do in 5 years.
I love that. Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, it is amazing the pace of change today. So like in 5 years, God knows what it's going to be like.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, AJ. It's been great chatting with you.
Thank you, Paula.
I hope you enjoyed episode 4 out of 5 in this special 5-part series, which we are airing in anticipation of episode 500. Episode 500 is going to air on April 24th on 4/24/24. In the lead up to our big episode 500 celebration, we wanted to look back on 5 of our favorite episodes from the early days of the Afford Anything podcast. So what you just heard today was number 4 out of 5 in this special 5-part series. Now, all of these episodes originally aired during the first couple of years that this podcast existed, 2016 and 2017. And back then, we didn't have as big of a community as we have right now. So you might not have heard this episode back in 2016 or 2017. Or if you did, you've probably forgotten it because that was a long time ago. And so we are sharing this special 5-day, 5-part series to give you a chance to hear some of our favorite episodes that came from those early days. So thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you tomorrow for episode 5 out of 5. And spoiler alert, tomorrow's guest, Vicky Robin. See you then.